Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today Justice John Browning from the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas. Welcome, Judge, to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We're glad to have you on the show, Judge, and we're really looking forward to visiting with you. You have quite a background in not only as a practicing lawyer, but as a legal historian. You want to tell the audience a little bit about your background and where you come from?
Sure. Well, I graduated from UT Law in 89 and joined a mid-sized insurance defense firm, made partner in 5 years, got to have a tremendous amount of courtroom experience at a very early juncture, both actually trial and appellate experience, got, you know, thrown into the trenches right away, and very varied type of docket, as you can imagine, being insurance defense. And after I was a partner there for a few years, I started my own small law firm, did that for about 10 years. Expanded the range of work that I did. And of course, just tort reform had its effects on the Texas court system. I did a lot more in the way of commercial litigation, employment law, intellectual property. I was also, my law partner was an IP guy with a PhD in physics from a little school named Princeton. So we made a pretty good pair because I didn't have the technical background that he had, but I had the courtroom background. So we did a lot of IP defense, patent infringement, copyright infringement, trademark infringement, all over. And after that, I became a partner with the first of several national law firms in their Dallas offices. Did that. Got tired of the national law firm scene for a little bit. Not everyone on either coast has the kind of regard for Dallas that we would perhaps like them to have. And they don't always get the way we do things in Texas. I then was recruited by one of Dallas's oldest law firms and was a partner there for about 4 years. And then I felt kind of like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, you know, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in. And another national firm came calling with kind of a different approach and mindset. And so I joined Spencer Fain. They were a Midwestern-based firm, Kansas City. Enjoyed working there tremendously. Had a lot of friends who were there, including folks in the technology realm that I'd been working with for years. And when they said, come on over to Spencer Fain, it was a very nice invitation. And I was happy there. And then circumstances came about that led to the opportunity to serve on the court.
You had a pretty broad litigation background, it sounds like. But you've been practicing as an appellate lawyer and have good experience even obviously before taking the bench in that area as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I think I tried my first case within a couple of months of being licensed, but I had my first reported appellate decision in 90. So within the first year that I was licensed. And like a lot of mid-sized firms and smaller firms, when you don't have the luxury of an appellate lawyer or an appellate section to rely upon, a lot of times to defend my own wins, a summary judgment that might get appealed or defense verdict, or to, you know, correct the occasional, as I would put it, mistake by the trial judge or the jury, I'd wind up, you know, handling the appeal and having to, you know, handle it myself. So, I didn't view that as daunting a challenge as maybe some lawyers, because I've always loved to write. And when you're the lawyer who's tried the case or argued the summary judgment, no one's going to know the issues that are framed better than you will. And so that's how I got a lot of my appellate experience early on, was, you know, on my own cases. And of course, it evolved from there to where I was being, you know, brought in to assist with appeals from underlying cases that I hadn't been involved with. But I had a great and varied experience. I think I've argued before justices on, I think, 11 of the 14 intermediate appellate courts, and have had cases that went up to the Texas Supreme Court.
Always thought that, you know, even if you want to do appeals, having a litigation background is helpful. And I think the same is true for litigation. If you have done some appeals, you kind of understand how they blend together in the ways that I think it makes you better at both.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, some firms, you know, view having an appellate lawyer with the trial team at trial can be a luxury, but, you know, I think it's more of a necessity. Obviously, if you can do that, if the case budget justifies that, that would be my preference all the time.
Yeah, Todd and I are both big proponents of that, not just for self-interested reasons, but we both totally agree with you.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. So, well, I know you have a keen interest in legal writing and, you know, your experience on the appellate side of your practice, that certainly seems to fit. Was there something else that influenced you? I mean, you are a very widely published author, written a number of law review articles. So what drives you to do that?
Well, two things. And I guess my wife jokes that I write for a couple of different audiences. You know, one is the audience that remembers, you know, the, you know, day-to-day sort of stuff, a humor column in the Bar Journal or Texas Lawyer or something like that. And, you know, then there's the maybe smaller crowd that gives out awards. And I've been fortunate some of my writing has gotten awards. But actually, half the time I hear myself referred to as very prolific. I'd rather they just say a good writer, but prolific, I'll take that. You know you're writing too much when Stephen King sends you an email and says, slow down. No, that didn't happen. That's just my prolific joke. But yeah, I actually had, you know, I've had a lifelong love of writing. And I was fortunate that, you know, a lot of people in law school have formative experiences. Maybe it was, you know, getting to work on the Law Review. I did not grade onto Law Review. I did walk past the Law Review office on my way to the law library every day. So I did have that experience. My wife works at SMU Law School, and her job actually is working with the Law Reviews. So we find it kind of funny that, you know, I'm married to someone who, you know, gets to experience that day to day that I never did. But I've had my revenge by publishing in a lot of law reviews. But I actually had a different kind of formative experience. I got to work. I was the very first research assistant hired by a then young law professor with one book to his name named Brian Garner. As you know, Brian has gone on to a multitude of bigger and better things. He's basically, you know, the legal writing and legal usage icon. And, you know, at the time that he was advertising for a research assistant, the first he'd ever hired, I was a 3L at UT. You know, for some strange reason, you know, he was impressed enough that he hired me. Maybe he felt sorry for me. I don't know. And the experience was wonderful. We've remained, you know, friends ever since. And, you know, I count him as an incredible influence and mentor and blessing in my life. When people say, well, what did you do? Did you help write, you know, this dictionary or that work? And though I'm credited in a few things more kindly than I deserve, probably, I analogize it to, even if you're just cleaning the paint brushes of Michelangelo, you're still working with Michelangelo. So my work, you know, for Brian involved a lot of things that some people would find tedious or drudgery, you know, pouring through Scottish law dictionaries from the 1400s, but I enjoyed it immensely. And that's just, again, something that Brian and I have in common is a love of the language.
What a great experience. No wonder you have become such a prolific legal writer with your kind of getting your start there.
And I think prolific is an accurate description. I mean, it seems like every time I open the Bar Journal, there's a picture of now Justice John Browning in an article he's written about something of interest to me, usually technology related or ethics related or something that affects me in my practice. Although, you know,
I appreciate that.
We've mentioned briefly, you've kind of taken a little slant lately toward legal history.
Well, I still, you know, I have my, you know, fingers in a lot of pies, still do a lot of technology writing, just approved my next technology piece for Texas Bar Journal. We have a special lawyers and cybersecurity issue coming out in December that I've organized and contributed to. This morning, I, you know, did an interview with a reporter for Reuters on the new proposed federal court jury instructions on basically addressing and admonishing against juror online misconduct, you know, researching the case on the internet, communicating on social media, that sort of thing. And I still, you know, do a great deal of things on technology in the law, but, you know, I'm a historian by training. I've always loved history and have gotten to work on some pretty fascinating history-related projects.
And I know that you have a technology and social media article that came out in this week's Appellate Advocate. So if you're listening, go look that up in the Appellate Advocate. It's a great article about social media.
Thank you. Appreciate the plug.
Well, we'll always plug the Appellate Advocate as
that's right.
what I always call the flagship publication of the State Bar Appellate Section.
That's right.
It's a very esteemed list of former editors, I will say.
And current ones.
and current ones. But I'll pull you aside after the show, Jody, and ask how come it's now taking four people to do the job of what used to be one.
And it seems to have taken a while between issues, but I say that maybe too harshly because I'm, you know, in addition to my work with the Bar Journal, you know, being editor in chief for the Journal of the Supreme Court Historical Society, I know all too well the challenges of, you know, getting a publication out, whether it's quarterly or monthly.
Well, you mentioned the Supreme Court Historical Society. That journal has been very well received and widely recognized of late, mm-hmm. I've noticed.
Well, I attribute that to the fantastic foundation that it's had under David Furlow and Marilyn Duncan. You know, they did yeoman labor on that and had some great input. I was privileged to have some of my work published in there. And then when they wanted to transition to someone new, I was incredibly, you know, honored that they would think of me, you know, stepping into what were very big shoes. So I look upon myself really just as trying to be a good steward of what they had built.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. Your interest in technology topics, did that develop during the time that you had your small firm and you were doing a lot of IP related work, or what led to that?
Yeah, it's kind of unusual because I don't come from a techie background. You know, I was a liberal arts major in college. And really what happened, it grew out of my background in trying cases. You know, an insurance defense litigator for, you know, a good chunk of my background, I was used to a company like a carrier saying, okay, we're going to get surveillance on this claimant or plaintiff, and we believe, you know, they may be exaggerating or lying about this or that. And so I was used to trying to gather information that I could use to attack, you know, my opponent. But then in 2004, with the advent of Facebook and then other social media platforms, I soon realized that people were sharing a lot of this information voluntarily. And the sort of things that I was used to having to hire a PI to go and get, people were posting out there for all the world to see. And I thought, this is great. I've got to use this. So I started using it. And I started using it to great advantage and getting some, you know, terrific results. Lawyers took notice and asked me to speak on it. Bar associations, write articles about it. And after I'd done that for a while, West Publishing approached me and said, look, we've been looking for someone to do a book on this, what they regarded as kind of a phenomenon. Now we know it's really here to stay. And I said, well, I'd be happy to contribute to a book and write a chapter or two. I'd done that for other publications. But they said, no, you're the guy in this field. We want you to write the book. So I came out with what was, I guess, the first, and it's still, I mean, it's actually used as a text in law schools around the country, The Lawyer's Guide to Social Network, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law, in 2010. And that, you know, did very well, resulted in a follow-up book, The Social Media Litigation Practice Guide, which came out in 2014. And West, at that point, wanted more of a nuts and bolts guide, a desk reference, if you will, for lawyers to use. And although I'd had individual chapters in both of those books on legal ethics and the ethical consequences of social media use or misuse, you know, I didn't even think about the idea of doing an entire book on that subject. And then the ABA approached me and a good friend and colleague of mine, Professor Jan Jacobowitz at University of Miami Law School, and said, look, we'd like an entire book on legal ethics and social media. And so in 2017, we came out with our book from the ABA on legal ethics and social media. So it really kind of is mushroomed.
So you've literally written the book on social media use in the law.
Yeah.
Several times, in fact.
Yes, several times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you use social media much yourself?
I do. Well, I say that I've been accused of not tweeting and posting as much as I should. People expect me to because of, you know, that background. I'm more an observer or lurker on those sort of things. As someone who's been a judicial candidate, I realize the importance of social media from a, you know, an election standpoint. And so I'm pretty conscientious about that. But in terms of tweeting and posting, I've always regarded my life is not very interesting mm-hmm. and not all that worthy of, you know, tweets and Facebook posts or Instagram worthy or things like that. So I really don't share as much. In fact, I've been critical of most of the rest of the world for oversharing. So I tend to be, you know, very limited on that. And as I joke to people who are far more active on social media, you know, and approach Kardashian-like proportions, I tell them, you know, I don't have time to, you know, post that much because I'm writing about people using social media. So, you know, there are only so many hours in the day.
That's right.
You're like the safari leader observing the wildlife. You know, you're not out getting in the middle of it as much, but you're observing and taking notes.
I'm very much like Marlon Perkins from, you know, Wild Kingdom, probably dating myself. And there's always Marlon, you know, pointing out for the audience. Now, Jim is going to pick up the 19-foot anaconda and demonstrate just how strong it really is. And as poor Jim is getting strangled to death, you know, by the anaconda, there's Marlon giving us all the, you know, color commentary. I like that approach.
It's the safest approach these days.
It is the safest approach. I like writing about what other people are, you know, doing poorly or not intelligently on social media and their missteps and how to avoid those rather than, you know, doing them myself.
Switching gears a little bit, but another one of your interests that people may not know as much about is African-American legal history, particularly in Texas.
Yes.
How did you get into that area of interest?
Well, it is kind of odd. If you look at a picture of the Dallas chapter of the Society of African American History and Culture, it's an old organization founded back around the turn of the century by Carter Woodson, big historian. I'm pretty easy to pick out in the group picture as the white guy. So it is a little unusual, but, you know, I was a history major at Rutgers. I studied, you know, under, among other professors, a very preeminent professor in African American history, and in fact won an award as an undergraduate for a paper on all black units in the Revolutionary War. Of course, a lot of us are familiar with the movie Glory and critical role that African American troops played in the Civil War, but a lot of us forget that throughout our history, African Americans have, you know, served their country admirably, including from the very beginning. So I've always been interested in kind of the history of overlooked or underrepresented groups, and that really was kind of the genesis for that. And when I was chair of the Texas Bar Journal Board, we came out with an issue that was sort of themed under the We Were First banner, talking about trailblazers in different areas. You know, the first Asian American judge, the first Latina female attorney admitted to practice, you know, different milestone achievements. And in looking at that, I realized we hadn't answered the question of who was the first African American lawyer in Texas. And as I dug deeper into it, I found out it was kind of a mystery that historians, you know, either got wrong or didn't know or gave up on. And so I decided, because I like a challenge and because I'm kind of a glutton for punishment and lack of sleep, I decided to research that. And along with our former Chief Justice of the Fifth Court of Appeals, Carolyn Wright, we uncovered basically the answer, but also uncovered a lot of things that weren't already known and published the first of several articles in the Bar Journal. Then we did an article in the Howard University Law Review. And we found some, you know, I mean, through research, found some amazing connections. For example, you know, the first African-American county or district attorney in Texas was not, as the Dallas Morning News, you know, like to say, Craig Watkins of Dallas County. It was actually a lawyer from Fort Bend County back in the 1870s. And even Fort Bend County's historical commission and their official records of elected officials had omitted this guy. And oh. I found his oath of office and the election records. I found his letter of resignation, which came during Reconstruction. You know, all these things, all these stories that had been ignored or gotten wrong by history, it was a wonderful experience to be able to correct the record and to do that. And in fact, that first African-American lawyer who also was our first African-American county or district attorney and our first African-American judge in Texas, wound up moving to Kansas and arguing and winning a case before the Kansas Supreme Court that essentially laid the foundation for Brown v. Board.
Wow.
A Texas lawyer had a very real connection to probably the biggest civil rights milestone of our era.
I was going to say, who was the first African-American lawyer in Texas, and when were they actually admitted?
Sure. William Abram Price. And he was admitted approximately 1873 and was elected a county attorney. He had served as a JP before that, but was elected Fort Bend County Attorney in 1876.
You shared with us in advance some of your articles, including the one with Justice Wright, Chief Justice Wright and Howard. And that's all very interesting. But I saw the one that you had sent about Austin's first African-American lawyer. And the, the folks here are very familiar with the name Heman Marion Sweat.
Yes.
Our local courthouse is named after him. But I venture to say that not nearly as many are familiar with the name John N. Johnson.
Yeah.
You describe as the first African-American lawyer in Austin.
Yeah. In fact, he was the first African-American admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of Texas, which back in 1883 was not a common thing for lawyers, you know, to do. You usually had to have a case pending in front of the Supreme Court to seek admission. But we found his signature right there on the rolls, the official rolls in the Supreme Court archives. And he was a fascinating guy because he was kind of like Black Lives Matter before there was a Black Lives Matter. He spoke out. He filed the first civil rights suits in Texas, suing railroads for their separate and unequal accommodations for African-American passengers. He spoke out against exclusion of African Americans on juries over 100 years before Batson. He spoke out against the deaths of African Americans in police custody long before George Floyd or Breonna Taylor. He was advocating and writing about these things and was just a fascinating individual. I actually have an article coming out that's probably my most in-depth look. It's more of a, my previous articles have been shorter. This one is like a law review length that relies on a lot of primary source material that I uncovered.
Well, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit. You actually kind of advocate for some restorative justice and some posthumous bar admissions. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, with regard to John N. Johnson, you know, he was actually denied admission the first two times he applied. And I believe on probably, you know, racial grounds, though he was eventually admitted to practice and then admitted to practice before the Supreme Court. You know, there's actually a movement afoot at the city of Bryan, where he was originally an attorney before moving to Austin, and they're seeking a historic marker. And when I asked them, you know, where they intended to place it, they're going to, they talked about the Brazos County Courthouse. And I said, that's pretty a good bit of karma because that's the courthouse where he was rejected twice and also, you know, was on the receiving end of some discriminatory rulings in representing clients. But in terms of lawyers of color or aspiring lawyers of color, I started researching that area, which has been a fascinating subject around the country, because about half a dozen times we've seen state Supreme Courts around the country decide to right a wrong from the 19th century and grant posthumous bar admission to minority lawyer. And we found examples, African-American, Asian-American, and so forth, who were wrongfully denied admission simply on the basis of race. And sometimes it's at the instigation of local bar associations or descendants of theirs. I'm actually involved in a couple of efforts like that. In addition to being a scholar who writes about it, I got interested in trying to help seek that kind of justice. And we've actually got a petition before the Texas Supreme Court right now that the Dallas Bar Association passed and current presidents and a local judge have essentially joined Chief Justice Wright and myself in asking the court to posthumously admit an African-American man who was denied admission on racial grounds back in 1882. And looking into that. And then I'm actually helping the Seneca Nation with a Native American from the 1840s who was denied admission to the New York bar because of the fact that he was a Native American and therefore they didn't consider him a citizen.
It's so interesting and so important to remember the context that that happened in and push to right those wrongs. Thank you for all your work bringing that to people's attention and moving to fix those things.
Thank you.
It really is fascinating.
It's just coincidental that it comes at a time when you know, the national dialogue about systemic racism and past injustices is ongoing. And I've always been, as a historian, someone who believes that you can't move forward, you can't avoid, you know, the mistakes of the past unless you learn about them.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Well, let's talk about your pathway to the Fifth Court of Appeals. If I recall correctly, you mentioned having been a political candidate.
Yes.
Before. I think that Republican primary from a while back was that one of the ones that was really stacked, lots of candidates?
Well, actually, I won the Republican primary, won a contested primary, three-way primary in 2018. That was my first foray. And that was at a time when, up until then, with an all-Republican court, everyone regarded the toughest thing as just, you know, winning the Republican primary. After that, you were supposedly a shoo-in. Well, apparently not my year, because 2018 was a rough year if you had an R behind your name and were a judicial candidate or a judge in Texas. And I don't have to tell you, you know, the effect was statewide on the appellate courts. And in Dallas, where there hadn't been a Democrat on the court since the early 90s, and we had 8 out of the 13 seats were up, I was one of the 8 Republican candidates, and we all lost in the wave, the blue wave of Beto mania and straight ticket voting. And, you know, that was it. And I never left private practice, so I wasn't really missing anything. It was unfortunate for 6 outstanding incumbents, you know, that either retired or returned to private practice. But, you know, I didn't know that there'd be another opportunity, and it certainly wasn't the circumstances that I ever would have wished for. But another opportunity sadly came about.
Well, and you're speaking, just so everyone is clear, you're speaking about the very untimely death of Justice David Bridges in an automobile crash. That was really awful to hear about. I really couldn't believe it, because as I was mentioning before we started recording today, I mean, my first 6 years of practice were spent in Dallas. And he was on several of my panels going back. This is back in the late 90s. And just couldn't have met a nicer man and someone who,
absolutely,
another one of those. I'm so happy to be able to report to people good experiences as a young lawyer dealing with people who had been on the appellate courts for quite a while, even at that time, mm-hmm, and who were just so kind and thoughtful and treated me well as a young lawyer, not like I didn't know anything at all, or, you know, genuinely interested. You know, that's something that we don't probably talk about enough on this show, is, mm-hmm, the relationship between the appellate bar and the appellate judiciary, and how we do talk all the time about how the bar itself is a very cordial group, but that cordiality, you know, passes between members of the bar and the judiciary as well. Because just like you see the same lawyers over and over again, you as a judge see the same advocates over and over again, and the advocates see the same judges. And so Justice Bridges really was a class human being, in my
absolutely
opinion. And I know a lot of other people share that opinion. So it is tragic that that was the way that the pathway was open to you. But there's some unique features, not only to the circumstance under which you got the opportunity to take the bench, but the method by which you've taken it. Because if I understand and remember correctly, not only did you obtain a gubernatorial appointment to fill out Justice Bridges' unexpired term, but you had to go through some wrangling to be placed on the November ballot, right?
Yeah. So, you know, David was killed July 25th, and I was still reeling from this, you know, just mere days later, when local Republican leaders, county chairs and others, were reaching out to me saying, we're going to have to replace Justice Bridges on the ballot, and we'd like you to put your name in consideration. Frankly, I wasn't really all that ready. I mean, I had, mm-hmm, spoken to David Justice Bridges just a couple of days before his death. And as always, he was very encouraging, you know, of things. And, you know, he was one of the ones who encouraged me originally to run for the bench in 2018. So it wasn't until I went, actually the night before David's funeral, and I saw his wife, Sandy, the visitation, and she took me aside and said, you know, David would want you to replace him on the court. And that meant a great deal. And I took that very seriously. And so I did agree to have my name put in consideration. And there were a number of other folks. There were two sitting judges who initially got into it. One later withdrew. You know, one young lawyer actually was on the verge of sending out a press release announcing when I think someone reminded him that you have to be practicing a minimum of 10 years to be an appellate justice. So I think his ambition maybe, you know, overreached his grasp. So, but in the end, you know, the precinct chairs and county chairs from all six counties in the 5th District had to choose between a judge from Dallas and myself. And fortunately, you know, during my campaign, when I had, you know, spent a lot of time throughout the district. Of course, as a lawyer, I'd handled cases in all six counties. I knew the judges. You know, I'd had a very active campaign during the primary, getting the nomination, and then leading up to the general election. I'd made a lot of good friends, and folks saw me as someone with that name recognition and with the qualifications, you know, 31 years of, you know, trial and appellate experience. And I guess they knew I could write too. they placed their trust in me, and I won that special election on August 15th overwhelmingly. And that got me on the ballot. And then shortly after, I heard from Governor Abbott's office, and they said, well, we'd like you to get your paperwork together because we'd like to consider appointing you. And I was very humbled and grateful that Governor Abbott appointed me on August 24th.
You've been there a little bit over a month, and it was really under kind of hurried circumstances. How has the transition from being a practicing lawyer to an appellate justice been?
It's been, as you said, it was kind of frantic. I had to wind up my practice, my private practice, and transition out of that. And, you know, as a partner with, you know, generating work for multiple lawyers throughout my firm, you know, with clients, you know, all over the country, you know, that was a bit of a challenge. But fortunately, I'd had a lawyer who had worked with me on behalf of those clients that, you know, had gotten them in front of those clients. And the transition was a pretty smooth one. Once I got on the court, that was like drinking from the fire hose, because in addition to getting on the court and having that tremendous transition, apparently, and this was just timing, it's not a rookie thing or anything like that, I also had writ duty for my entire first month. So in addition to the regular docket, I had to handle responsible for the on a panel of three justices responsible for the emergency writs and mandamus filings and so forth that needed to be addressed. So if you had a trial setting on a Monday and you were seeking an emergency stay and sent something on a Friday night, okay, you wrecked my Saturday, but you know, that comes with the territory. And so I had that, but you know, we have outstanding, you know, lawyers and staff at the Fifth Court of Appeals who were tremendous in helping me make that transition. Wonderful colleagues to work with. Everyone's been great. And, you know, everyone's been also very understanding of, you know, helping the new guy. So, but you know, with the appellate background that I had, you know, it's been a pretty good transition, and I was, you know, issuing my first opinion inside of a week. So,
wow.
Well, you were well prepared to do that. You knew what an appellate opinion should look like. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic.
There have been challenges, though, because as an advocate, I was used to, you know, preparing one side. And as a justice, mm-hmm. you're really investing a lot of time, if you're doing it right, and I try to do it right, in fully appreciating where both sides are coming from and appreciating their arguments. And I thought I prepared pretty hard as an appellate advocate, and that's nothing compared to, you know, the preparation I was putting in as a justice, getting ready for oral arguments and, you know, getting ready to, you know, issue an opinion.
Have you had oral arguments since you've been there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had, I think it was actually my second week, was the first week of Zoom oral arguments. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we even just recently had our first Zoom en banc rehearing, which, you know, getting 14 justices on on Zoom, along with, you know, the advocates for both sides, was pretty challenging. And the reason they were 14, we had a visiting justice who had sat on the original panel. And so in addition to all 13 of us current sitting justices on the Fifth Court, we had that visiting justice participate in the en banc as well.
How do you manage an en banc hearing for 14 judges on Zoom? Do you kind of have an order that you go by, or?
I think, and our Chief Justice, I think, made the very wise decision to make it clear to all of us justices that for the first however many minutes for each side, there were to be no questions. And that kind of, you know, enabled, because imagine being an appellate advocate, as you both, you know, are very well aware of that role, and having to respond, you know, right off the bat to mm-hmm. questions from not three, but potentially 14 justices. I mean, it's like being in a shooting gallery, right? So it was good that, you know, there were certain, you know, accommodations made in terms of, you know, letting both sides, you know, get kind of started on their central points before there'd be any questioning.
I'm picturing the en banc courtroom in the Fifth Circuit with all 16 or 17 chairs lined up in a U shape right around the podium. Yeah.
Well, and to that point, I don't know off the top of my head what the limit is on the Brady Bunch squares on a Zoom screen, but when you get to 14, are you looking at having to scroll over to another screen to see who's asking you the question as an advocate?
It actually, the Brady Bunch analogy was made by more than one of us justices in seeing the screen before we started. Very apt.
Well, the other thing about your recent experience is, you know, most of the time when someone gets appointed to the appellate bench, you know, they're having to fill out the unexpired term, which is technically what you're doing, but they usually have a little bit of lead time to build up to a campaign. Like, and you, I think your situation is 10 times harder than almost anybody else, even any other appointee, because you not only had to come in and try to learn the job, but you had to immediately, like no delay, start and putting all the, and you already had been through an election process. Mm-hmm. So you, I suspect, had a lot of the machinery there that you could tap to and restart. But yeah, you know, that had to be incredibly difficult. And here we are, you know, basically 30 days out from election day. You've been on the bench a month. Mm-hmm. So your cycle was 2 months. I mean, that's incredible, really.
Yeah, no, and if you look at, you know, the level of campaigning, I mean, I've been to events and gatherings and meetings, both in person and virtual, throughout the six counties, literally from, you know, the day after I was appointed. And, you know, I've got signs up, you know, hundreds of signs all up over the six counties and posting regularly on social media. Essentially, it's work all day. And frequently, you know, into the evening as, you know, schedule demands, and then, you know, campaign nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you know, I had earlier in the year made all these different writing obligations that had to be adhered to with different deadlines. So I was up till about 2 or 2:30 in the morning last night, putting the finishing touches on a law review article that I owed by October 1st. Nice. And technically it came in, you know, at 2 in the morning, October 2nd, but I was pretty close to meeting my deadline. Oh, and the new O'Connor's Business and Commerce Code Plus, or what some folks would say, what did you do on your summer vacation? I had taken on a side gig as becoming an editor along with two law professors from Houston. And if you get your new O'Connor's Business and Commerce Code Plus, you'll see John Browning, you know, on that as well. And so that was a fun 1300 pages, you know, or so to work on. So yeah, it's been pretty busy, but you know, if you can just do without those little things like sleeping, you know, it's not a problem.
Well, you just got to make it. It's kind of like studying for the bar exam, I suppose. You just got to make it for another 30 days or so. Mm-hmm. And then the result will be, and you know, I'm sure you will feel good about having done your best under the circumstances. I mean, I couldn't, certainly don't envy that. That seems like an incredible schedule to try and keep, and you know, probably no days off at all.
No, there are no days off. Or as my wife likes to ask, so, you know, which county are we headed to today? Type of thing. You know, if this is Tuesday, it must be, you know, Collin County or, you know, I mean, I it's just, and some days there are multiple events in a single day and you just do your best. And, you know, one reason people gave me the shot was seeing what I was capable of in 2018 and leveled the drive that I brought to it. And, you know, nobody worked harder. So I may be out fundraised. I may be outspent, but I'm not going to be outworked.
Well, now that you've been on the bench for a month, you've had the experience of oral argument and writing opinions on behalf of the court. Is there anything that surprises you about the way things look from that side of the bench?
Yeah, I think I've gained a whole new respect for, you know, the work that our staff attorneys do in a variety of different areas and our staff, period. You know, when we appellate courts throughout Texas had the big ransomware attack, the Fifth Court actually was relatively unscathed because of some of their cybersecurity measures. So I was very happy with kind of the commitment to technology that the Fifth Court has had. And they've always been a leader among the courts in terms of technology. But just the level of preparation, you know, as advocates, I'd always been used to the prepping of one side. I mean, you obviously will prepare to and know the record inside and out to anticipate, you know, what the other side is arguing or emphasizing. But, you know, as a judge, if you're doing it the right way, you know, you really are seeing everything from both sides. And that takes a lot. And that was eye-opening for me.
I bet.
We kind of reached the time that we told you we would take, but we always like to ask our guests at the end if they've got a tip or a war story that they'd like to share.
Sure. Well, you know, I think I've got an article coming out in the Scribes Journal, which covers legal writing. And the article of mine is, I think it's entitled, How Not to Impress a Judge with Your Writing. So I guess and it's a little bit more lighthearted, although it's got some serious things. But my, you know, some of the observations that I've made that I would pass on as tips, I think the quarantine, the pandemic sort of mentality has affected a lot of folks in the legal profession. And what I'm seeing in some of the briefs, you know, there's a little bit more snarkiness or a little bit more prone to personal attacks or criticisms. I don't think that really gets you far. I can tell you it doesn't impress us as justices. And so, you know, one tip is certainly, you know, refrain from that sort of thing. The other is, you know, don't misrepresent either the record or the authority, because we really do read those things. And it is, and of course, you know, we're always expect, but are particularly impressed when attorneys go above and beyond with respect to adhering to the duty of candor. And recently, we had an attorney who alerted us in a letter brief that since he had filed, you know, his brief, and this was prior to oral argument, he wanted to just be upfront and say, hey, a case has come down that really kind of guts, you know, my central argument. And of course, he's going to do his best as an advocate to distinguish that case, you know, from his. But the important thing is that he brought this to the court's attention. It wasn't something that he tried to, you know, hide or hope we wouldn't see or something like that. And I can tell you the reaction by me and my fellow justices, you know, that really enhances the credibility of someone like that. And so, you know, that's very important, not just not misrepresenting something, but, you know, living up to that duty of candor.
It's a great reminder for all of us to, you know, number one, keep checking the law before your oral argument, make sure nothing new has come out. But then,
yeah,
you know, be upfront and just deal with it, because yeah, the court's going to find it if you don't.
Right.
Which is even worse.
That's right.
Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com, message us on Twitter or Instagram @texapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.